to episode 8 of our podcast. It's the episode where we have our new fancy soundboard for the first time, our new fancy mic. We're using it for the first time. We had to do now 4 takes on the intro in order to get it right because of various errors. And it is also going to be the episode where we have our very special guest. All right, so our guest this week is Member of Parliament Heather McPherson, who is not only the Member of Parliament from Edmonton Strathcona, which is my riding in Alberta, but she is also the Deputy House Leader of the NDP, the Critic for International Development, Deputy Critic for Foreign Affairs, Deputy Critic for Heritage, as well as being the only Member of Parliament for the NDP from Alberta, Mother of Dragons, Breaker of Chains. Heather, did I miss anything?
I think you got it.
All right, fantastic. Well, thank you again for being here. We're so excited to have you. You're our first celebrity guest. All right, so, I mean, we had this whole outline that we were just going to go through stuff, and we're still hoping to get through most of it, but also we've just had an insane week, past
2 weeks,
that I feel like it's just not possible to ignore. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on what's going on in the U.S. and what started to happen in Canada and just everything that's going on with all the protests and everything?
Yeah, it's been a busy couple of weeks for sure. I mean, frankly, I can even start back when I got elected and say that this, ever since, basically since January 1st, it's been crazy. But in this last little bit in the Black Lives Matter movement and the response in the U.S. to the murder of George Floyd and sort of what that's looked like in Canada has been, it's been really important. And I think that what I'm seeing is this feeling from not just the Black community, certainly not just the Indigenous and the people of color community, but so many Canadians are recognizing this, the structural violence that we have, the structural racism and colonialism that we have in Canada. And maybe it doesn't look the same in all parts of Canada. You know, I think when I think about Alberta, I think that the colonialism and racism that affects our Indigenous populations is something that is so ingrained, so structurally built into and baked into our system and needs to be so fundamentally weeded out. It's crazy to hear the story about Chief Allen Adams that came out yesterday about how he him and his wife were beaten by the RCMP officers. Just illustrates this place where we've gotten to, where we have such deeply embedded structural violence that happens against Black, Indigenous, and people of color that needs to be rooted out. And I mean I welcome that these protests are happening. I welcome that these marches are happening. You know, I welcome seeing politicians participate and be at these different events, but it certainly can't be seen as enough. You know, I don't think Don Iverson's response was enough. I don't think our federal response has been enough. Certainly we haven't even really heard from our provincial government. So,
yeah,
except that they were mad they weren't invited.
the it's nice to have all the words, but it needs to be followed up by some action.
Yeah. And there are things we know that we could do that could happen right now, you know, that would be easy things to do. And those are actions we need to take, and we need to take them at all levels of government and individually as well.
Yeah. I just want to throw in for some of our listeners in Ontario and outside of Canada, Don Iverson is the mayor of Edmonton.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's fine. I think
we have 4% listenership in Belgium.
So. Yeah.
Hi, Belgium.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I agree. It needs to be shown from action. And I mean, I have to say in places like Ontario and Alberta and on the federal level, I'm not too hopeful that will actually happen, because I think there's a lot of governments right now where they're very good at the pretty words, but less so on the action side of things.
Well, and a perfect example is, you know, our prime minister attended, I was at the at the rally in Ottawa on Friday, and the Prime Minister attended and he took a knee. We all did. But, you know, his minister, Bill Blair, was the architect of carding in Toronto. And so who cares if you take a knee if the person that you've put in charge, if the minister is in fact somebody who was an architect of developing these plans for structural racism within our communities.
Yeah, Justin Trudeau is very good at the flashy, looking good in front of the camera most of the time, but not a lot of substance I found behind him.
Well, certainly he has room. He has room to grow on this issue. That's certain.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. So,
should we dive into the questions that we had written? First, what made you want to enter politics, and specifically, why the NDP?
So yeah, this is probably the question I get asked most frequently, and it's interesting to me because I actually didn't want to enter politics. This was not a goal for me. This has not been a lifelong ambition that I've had. It actually came about in 2014. Linda Duncan had asked me if I would consider running for Edmonton Centre. They were looking for a candidate for Edmonton Centre, and I wouldn't run in a riding I didn't live in, so mm-hmm. I declined. And then, you know, Linda did ask me a couple more times, and then when she decided she wasn't going to be running in Edmonton Strathcona, she asked again if I would consider running. And, you know, I talked to my husband, I talked to my kids, I talked to my parents, and I think part of what ultimately made me decide to put my name forward was the idea that I'd been doing advocacy work and I'd been working with the federal government for a long time and found it increasingly frustrated the speed at which things did not happen, like how slow things changed. And you know, my husband said, well, this is an opportunity for you to speed it up. This is a chance for you to push forward. And this is this opportunity for you to do all those things that you're always talking about and are so enraged about. And so that was why I decided to put my name forward. And in terms of why the NDP, I have always supported the NDP. I've been a volunteer. I've been on the EDA's Electoral District Associations. And I think it's based on values. I mean, I think that, and I've said this before, but I think I have a really strong, that's not fair. The thread through my personality. Mm-hmm. And I just see the injustice, I see the inequality, and the NDP values of making sure that that we are working with workers, that we are protecting people, that we're making sure everybody can thrive really resonates with me. It really makes sense. And I think maybe because I wasn't in politics, like I wasn't really a political animal, the winning part wasn't really that as important to me as, you know, like I really just wanted to be representing people and be fighting for the things that I know are right.
Yeah.
Sounds a little hokey.
No, I mean, it's good.
As good a reason to get into politics as there can be, I think.
And actually, I've been saying you can ask Dylan, I've said forever, the pace at which government does things is, it wouldn't be acceptable in any other business. And somebody who's going in there to make a change and to try to get things done, I have to applaud that. I'm totally on board with that.
Thanks, James.
I'm just curious. When did you first sort of become politically aware and like aware of the NDP and like who was the leader that drew you in, or was it a leader? Was it just the core values, or when did it all begin?
Oh, politically aware, I think for a long time. So a lot of my focus has always been on sustainable development, international development, a lot of that work, that was a focus for me. And so for a long time, I've been, you know, following what's happening with the government, because Canada's role in the world, I think, is pretty fundamental in how we see ourselves as citizens of the world, as we see ourselves as global citizens, I think is really important. So I've been pretty aware of where that's been going for, gosh, since 25 years, I suppose, 25, 30 years. In terms of the NDP, I mean, there's always, I'm not sure if I would say it was a leader. I mean, everybody, of course, loved Jack Layton, and maybe the leader that actually drew me most towards the NDP may actually have been, I mean, it may have actually been Linda Duncan, because she was local, and you saw her, and you saw her working. You know, I think, yeah, that's an interesting question, but I would not say it was the leadership so much as the values that have pushed me into the NDP.
Well, that's, I think that's what it should be, really. The values.
Yeah, leaders come and go, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so it should be the values. I think that's fantastic. So now you're in there, you're elected, and you have all these many jobs, of which we only listed some of them. Now, one of the things that I doubt many people know is what a house leader is, and never mind what a deputy house leader is. So what exactly is your job? What are your responsibilities as the deputy house leader for the NDP?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be totally open here, but when Jagmeet phoned me to ask me if I would consider being the deputy house leader, I wasn't 100% sure what all of the job was either. So I completely understand how some people may not know what that position is. So I work really, really closely with Peter Julian. Peter Julian's our MP from Burnaby Westminster, and he is our house leader. And so I'm the deputy that works sort of underneath him, and we work quite closely. He mentors me. I'm extraordinarily lucky to have such a strong leadership model for me. But what the house leader does is each political party has a house leader, and the house leaders work together to get things done. So they negotiate on behalf of the entire party. They decide on how things are going forward, which things aren't going to go forward, you know, all sorts of things that have to sort of the day-to-day business of parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really interesting. So prior to March, that meant that, you know, figuring out when private members or opposition days in the House of Commons would be, or figuring out what the structure of things would look like, or how many days we would sit, or what the calendar was, or, you know, the business, I guess, of Parliament. Once COVID-19 was declared a pandemic, being a deputy house leader became a whole different ballgame, because all of a sudden we were in totally uncharted territory, and everybody had to work together and negotiate. The four official parties had to work together and negotiate to figure out what it would look like and what Parliament looks like. And we couldn't have all the MPs together, so we had to figure out a system for how that would look. And, you know, how many people will be in the house? How do we stay distant? How do we stay safe and follow the recommendations of our health professionals? So for the past 12 weeks, it's been wild to be involved in a house leader situation. But again, it's like I said at the very beginning, I feel like I haven't had any traditional or normal or regular parliamentary experience. It just hasn't been that kind of a parliament yet.
Yeah, just tossed right into one disaster, yeah, after another, one issue after another. It's crazy.
Yeah, literally. It started with the economic collapse in Alberta, and it moved toward, you know, then we had a massive plane crash with flight 752 that had many, many, many Edmonton Strathcona people on that flight, you know, and then COVID-19. Yeah. It's been wild.
Yeah. Well, at least you're not bored.
Not your typical first year.
I know. Linda Duncan has texted me and said, well, we never had to do anything.
Dylan said, at least you're not bored. Just going to mention a couple of the committees that you're on: the COVID-19 Pandemic Committee, Subcommittee on International Human Rights, Subcommittee on Agenda and Procedure of the Standing Committee on Canadian Heritage, the Canadian Heritage Committee, as well as vice chair of the Canada-Africa Parliamentary Association, member of the Canada-Europe Parliamentary Association, Canada-Ireland Interparliamentary Group, Canada-Israel Interparliamentary Group, Canadian-NATO Parliamentary Association, Canadian branch of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, Canadian section of Parliamericans, Canada-United Kingdom Interparliamentary Association, Canadian delegation to the Organization for the Security and Cooperation in Europe Parliamentary Assembly, and the Canadian group of the Interparliamentary Union. So that sounds like it's going to keep you busy. But the question I have is, what's the difference between, say, a committee, a parliamentary association, and an interparliamentary group?
It's a great question. There's a few things. So first of all, in terms of a committee, there's different types of committees. So there are standing committees that we have within Parliament that are always active, that are, you know, the Finance Committee, the Foreign Affairs Committee, Agriculture Committee, whatever the case may be. Those are committees. They're part of government business. They can have either just members of Parliament or members of Parliament and senators. Their work is paid for. It's very much focused on issues related to their topic of expertise. So for example, the Foreign Affairs Committee would very much, would do studies on different issues that are affecting foreign affairs and Canada's role in the world. So those are the business of government. And in fact, where a lot of actual work happens in the government. So, you know, we all see question period in the House of Commons and the chamber, but what happens at committees is really actually where a lot of the work happens. So that's, they're a more formal structure. They're more formalized. There's certain ways that things are done within committee. The committee reports back to the House of Commons. So that's the more formal structure. The friendship groups, the parliamentary groups are a little bit different. The parliamentary groups are diplomatic sort of in nature. So they are paid for by the Parliament, and you know, they're basically in place so that you can develop stronger diplomatic and parliamentary ties between other countries. And there is support for those. They are given staff. There is often travel between parliaments, that kind of thing. And then the friendship groups are sort of a more informal version of that. So they are not funded, but they are, again, that sort of attempt for diplomacy and for greater understanding between countries or between groups. So, for example, I'm also on the Canada-Ukraine friendship group, and that's not paid for through the government or the House of Commons. It is something that is a sort of a less formal structure, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so sort of developing the soft power that they say Trump is losing these days.
Yes, definitely. And I've said time and time again that as a middle power country, we really need diplomacy. We need to work with allies to be able to have a strong position on things like Canada, China, or whatnot. And actually, that brings up a good point too, is that in terms of committees, there are standing committees that always meet, and then there can be legislative or special committees that are put together for a particular purpose. And the China Canada Committee, which is in place now, is one of those non-standing. We don't always have a China Canada Committee, but we do right now.
Because of the Huawei situation?
Well, I think there's a number of things. The Huawei situation, obviously the two Michaels, Hong Kong, what's happening in Hong Kong with the one country, two system rule. You know, there's an enormous amount to look at there. So if the China Canada relationship was kept solely within the Foreign Affairs Committee, there may not be enough time within that committee to explore other issues of foreign affairs.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, at least this is what it sounds like to me, would you agree that it feels like maybe the committees are less partisan than than, say, the chamber during question period, where it feels like, you know, it's important, but it's as much putting on a show as it is anything else, whereas maybe committees, people work together more, or is that not true?
Yes and no. That's my very political answer for you. So in the chamber, absolutely, there is quite a lot of showmanship. Some people have more showmanship than others. Some people like to heckle more than others. We've all seen it. Within committee, I wouldn't say that it's nonpartisan, because that you are allocated spots on a committee based on how many seats you have. So the structure of the committee itself is very partisan. There are a certain number of Liberals, a certain number of Conservatives, Bloc, and NDP. That said, because it's not on display the same way, there is the ability to be more collaborative. I do find people work better together on the committees, and you will find allies in different parties that you can build with. So while it definitely, you are an NDPer in committee, and that changes how much time you get to speak. That changes, the order in which you speak. All of those rules of process are still there, but you do have a little bit of opportunity to interact with others a bit more.
That's awesome. Yeah. That kind of brings up, though, another sort of just like quick question that I wanted to ask. And I find it kind of fun. But curious, could you name maybe three other MPs from other parties that you admire, that you've worked with a lot, that you have good relationships with? Because I think that's not something that, I guess, the populace gets to see a lot. Like, because again, we see probably the most hyper-partisan moments, because that's what's in the news, that's what's in the House. But three other MPs that, for whatever reason, you admire from other parties outside the NDP.
That's a great question, and it does kind of make me laugh. So right now, during COVID-19, of course, we do Zoom question period, so people can participate via a Zoom meeting the same way the rest of the world is living right now. And it's funny because before we go live, everybody's just chit-chatting on the Zoom call, and oh, how are your kids, and how is this, so it is a very funny thing that we are all colleagues and we all get along, and then of course that changes once everything starts, but it is interesting to think about. I think if I had to name three, I mean, one of my colleagues in close to Edmonton is Mike Lake. He works a lot with me, and he's the international development critic for the Conservative Party. And we work really, really well together, and I really appreciate his insight. I appreciate that I can chat with him about things, that we can work together in a nonpartisan way. So he's certainly one of the people I would say. Alexis Brunel Duceppe from the Bloc is another colleague of mine that I quite admire. He is pushing a lot on the same issues that I am, and one of those is making sure our ombudsman has the teeth to hold Canadian corporate interests to account when they are operating overseas, and that's something that's been really important to me for a number of years. And so being able to work with him on that is great, and being able to work cross-party to move an issue that's really important that would make the world a better place, to be able to do that together, I think is important. Who else? We've got there's a lot of great colleagues, and choosing three is really hard.
Yeah, that's it's almost unfair.
I will say Karina Gould is the Minister for International Development. She's got a bit of a tough slog. This government has not prioritized international development the way it should. And so she's in a tough situation, and I think she handles it with incredible grace and kindness. Jenica Atwin is another one. Yeah, from the Green Party.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, she's the member for Fredericton, isn't she?
Yeah, and she's just really lovely.
Nice, that's good. I like, I guess another freshman MP is good. It's nice.
Well, and it's funny because, of course, when you're in the conservatives or the liberals, you're part of these big, big, big teams. Mm-hmm. But there's only 24 NDP and there's only 3 Green. And so, you know, we often cross check notes because we're trying to do the same amount of work as these giant parties with much more resources. And so, yeah, we keep each other company.
Yeah. There's, I guess there's a sense of solidarity there.
Yeah, exactly. But just saying those names, that certainly doesn't exclude. I'm sure I'm going to get off the phone and think, oh, what about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there are lots of great people. And, of course, I get to work with some pretty spectacular MPs within the NDP party as well. So that's pretty great.
In the 2012 provincial election in Alberta, the Alberta NDP had 4 seats and just under 10% of the vote. In 2015, they won 54 seats with 40% of the vote. In 2019, they had 32.7% of the vote and 24 seats. In the federal election in 2019, the NDP got 11.5% of the vote in Alberta.
Yeah.
And in 2015, it was also around 11. So my question is, how do the federal NDP connect with the electorate that votes NDP provincially in Alberta?
Yeah. Well, and you can see by those numbers that, you know, we've got a lot of work to do in Alberta. There's a lot we can be doing. And I have thought about this a lot because one of the things that I find fascinating is how, you know, in the same year, an Albertan, obviously outside of Edmonton, Strathcona, but an Albertan could vote NDP in the provincial and Conservative in the federal. I find that very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a few things I think. First of all, obviously in Canada, we have the 3 major parties in Alberta. I mean, discounting the Bloc, of course, but those 3 major parties. So the progressive and centrist vote is split. So this is a big part of the problem. And part of that, of course, is our electoral reform system. And also a part of that, and I'm going to be a little partisan here, is that the Liberals typically campaign quite far left.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't necessarily how they govern, but they do campaign that way. And so until we can actually get people to recognize that the words don't match the actions, that's going to be something that's always going to be a problem for us. But I think the other thing too is that particularly in Alberta, I don't think we've been able to as effectively as I think we can and probably will get people to understand that for the most part, most Canadians actually probably are New Democrats. You know, most people, when you actually break it down and say, here's one of the things we believe in, do you believe in this? The resounding support for some of those fundamental principles is really, really strong. It's interesting to me. And the reason I bring this up too is during the last election campaign, we literally knocked on all the doors. We went to every neighborhood, we went to every street. And I don't even want to know how many doors I knocked on over the past year. And if you ever start talking to somebody who is, you know, I've only ever voted Conservative, I am a Conservative, I don't like the NDP. But then if you start having that conversation about, well, we think that, you know, an important thing is pharmacare. We're the only country in the world that has health care and doesn't have a pharmacare program to go with it. Yeah, I think that sounds great. That sounds like a good idea. You know, like we think that workers should have fundamental protections. And, you know, most people will say, yeah, we do as well. So I think it's getting that message out. And it does take time. And it also is, like, if you look at the Alberta NDP, it's these moments that happen. Like 2015 was a huge moment where people realized, oh, like, I can vote NDP. I'm not required to vote Conservative because I'm an Albert. And it's just it's flipping that switch, I think. And there's no easy answer. You do it by talking to people. You do it by going door to door and coming up with a plan or a vision for our country that resonates with Canadians and just doing the hard work.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to just throw back a little bit to something you mentioned earlier with the liberals campaigning to the left and then not governing that way. I remember in my literally poli-sci 101, one of the things that the professor mentioned is that a constant strategy in Canada is the parties that win campaigning to the left and then governing to the right, and that is like a historical trend. And then another thing that we talked about is, and we sort of noticed, or at least I sort of noticed a pattern, is the liberals seeming to pick ideas from the NDP that are popular and then campaigning on them, then not really doing anything about that. And that can be traced actually, like, as far back as I've noticed, is William Lyon Mackenzie King, because he was like obsessed with poll numbers and popular support. And when the CCF was ahead, he started taking their ideas, and that's how he managed to win more governments. And I think the liberals have just run with that ever since.
And even recently, electoral reform.
Yeah.
Two elections ago.
Yeah. And that didn't happen.
Well, and I think fear plays a role in it as well, because often, you know, the right is held up as sort of this specter of doom. Mm-hmm. So you better vote for us because we have the best chance at beating, you know, the right. So that's often used as well, that fear piece. And the solution's really easy. If we had electoral reform, you know, that would change things a lot.
Yeah,
everyone could just vote how they wanted. What an idea.
It's crazy. It's crazy talk. I also think that you mentioned, you know, people vote conservative because that's what their parents did and that's what their parents' parents did, so they think they have to. And also, you know, so much now we've been taught not to talk about politics or religion because you might start an argument. But it, then, you know, I think I've said this to Dylan, if you don't talk about politics and religion and then the uncomfortable topics, then you end up with a population that knows nothing about politics or religion.
Yeah.
Which isn't good.
Well, and that's a role. I mean, I also look at some of the cuts and some of the things that are happening within our education, our post-secondary and institutions, you know, and you think the best thing for Canada is to have a very smart electorate who can make good decisions and understand how things work. And in cuts to all of these education systems is devastating for that. That's not how you create a stronger Canada.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm in the, you know, I'm in university right now, and I have to absolutely agree. And that sort of brings us very nicely to the next thing we want to talk about, because I remember a lot when you were campaigning and I was following the campaign, and we went back and reviewed some videos. And one of the things that you talked about a lot was student debt. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but your first question in the House of Commons was also about student debt. You know, the New Democrats are they're not in government, but it is a minority parliament. By the end of your term, or at least your first term, what is the ideal situation you think you would like to see happen? And what are some, you know, like realistic goals that you think you can really achieve on that front before the next election?
Well, that is an excellent question, Dylan, and that will obviously be determined by when the next election is.
Yeah, I know, right?
So, yeah, and of course, we've been hearing everything from this fall to next spring to 4 years out. So even that part of the question is really fascinating for me. But listen, like, there are 28 countries in this world that post-secondary education is free. Many of them do not have the economic wherewithal that Canada has. There is no reason why we should not have affordable post-secondary education for every single student who wants to go to post-secondary. There's no reason to not be supporting that. So my utopia, my goal would be that we should be moving in that direction. We should be moving towards free post-secondary for all people who want to go to school. That's not likely going to happen in my first term.
Yeah.
Because the other interesting thing, I think, is that a lot of these issues that are so important are getting overshadowed by COVID, as could be expected. And so mm-hmm. one of our worries is, and I can talk about this a little bit later on, is how we build back a society after COVID-19 that A, doesn't bring in an austerity lens, but also B, doesn't miss the lessons we learned from the last 12 weeks. So that's something, if you'd like, I'm happy to talk about. But in terms of student debt, I think what we can do, and hopefully we can do this very, very quickly, there's zero reason not to, is take interest off student loans. So mm-hmm. students should not be paying interest on their student loans to the government. That's absurd. It would be an unbelievably simple fix. Mm-hmm. Let's just write that and that could be done. I also think we need to have much better systems in place to ensure that funding for less fortunate students is available. So more grants, more easier access to loans, easier access to grants, and I think also we've got to look at some of the funding mechanisms that go directly to our post-secondary institutions. You know, we're looking at the University of Alberta with a 20% operating cut. They have a $1 billion operating or infrastructure deficit at the moment. The Faculty Saint-Jean is one of the only Francophone campuses in Western Canada, and it is at the brink of collapse. So where is the federal government's role in ensuring that provinces are providing adequate support for post-secondary institutions? There's a whole bunch of those things, too, that we could look at. But absolutely, interest needs to come off the table. Absolutely, we need to get more grants and more student loan funding available for students.
Yeah,
that's the short-term stuff.
On a federal level, right now I know you get it from provincially. Or do you just think the feds need to encourage the provinces to do this?
But student loans are also federal.
Really?
Yeah, there's that mechanism comes through federal. When the interest is paid in, it comes to the federal government.
Okay. I just know I applied for my daughter to OSAP and for Dylan to the NWT, so I thought it was provincial, but
there are mechanisms that are provincial, but I think there is also, you know,
she knows.
You know better than us that there's absolutely the federal and the federal money is under the federal jurisdiction. So
yeah.
100%. And you know,
those are things we can move fast.
Yeah, and I mean, as a student at the University of Alberta, I, you know, again, COVID's bulldozed everything, but right before that happened, my entire class was really worried about the funding cuts, how it was going to affect us in the arts, which is already underfunded. We were really worried about it and potentially having to pay increased tuition. Like, a lot of us were like, oh, we can barely afford tuition as it is. So it's an issue that's very near and dear to my heart.
Yeah. Well, you know, the average Canadian before COVID-19, the average Canadian student was ending their undergraduate degree with about $30,000 worth of debt. And what that meant, what that fundamentally means is that wealthy people can afford to have more post-secondary education. Mm-hmm. And that's not fair. And that means that our, you know, a perfect example of that means that our lawyers become... we are perpetuating a system that keeps wealthy people getting wealthier and marginalizes others.
Yeah. So we'll talk about... Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I just wanted to jump in. I'm not sure if you're... I'm sure, well, you probably are, but the NWT has a great system where every year you spend in school up there, you earn one semester's worth of tuition so that if you go to school for... you're full from K to 12, you have 4.5 years or so paid for, and then as long as you come back to the NWT and work up there. So they're basically paying for you to get the skills, and then you come back to the NWT and apply those skills there, which mm-hmm. I thought was a great program, and you know, I'd love to see more provinces do something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think we'll get to sort of rebuilding the country post COVID right at the end, just to end on a message of hope. You know, just we like to do the nice things like that sometimes. So going from your sort of like main issue, student debt, and one of your priorities, on a more party level scale, what can you say about what are the NDP's priorities for the minority government, and what needs to be met for the Liberals to earn your support? I know at the beginning, before COVID, Jagmeet Singh put out, I think there was a list of three things that he said he wanted to see done in order for the Liberals to get NDP support. I completely forget what they are, but...
Well, this is what COVID-19 has done to us all.
Yeah.
we've all like lost the thread a bit. So one of the things that Jagmeet was speaking to the Prime Minister about was pharmacare. Mm-hmm. And that was one of our key priorities that we wanted to get in this parliament. It is absurd that we don't have universal pharmacare. You know, this is a system that is not only the best for people, it is also economically a really good, strong idea. Many conservatives are supportive of the idea of universal pharmacare as well. And our worry, of course, was that that the Prime Minister would say pharmacare and would not give us that key word that we really need, and that is the universal pharmacare. So we don't want a drug plan that it's being run by insurance companies. We want universal pharmacare that's available for all. So that was one of the big things. And like I said earlier, we are literally the only country in the world that has a Medicare plan that does not include a pharmacare plan. Like, this is a fundamental piece that will make lives better for Canadians. It makes so much sense on so many levels. So that was one of them. You know, another thing that we really wanted to see was that the Prime Minister would stop taking kids to court, Indigenous kids to court, and would settle their cases and stop with the court cases. So that was a big piece. And then for me, one of my biggest ones is the diversifying our economy. So I think Alberta is in this situation right now where, you know, it's we went into COVID-19 with the highest level of unemployment for young men 18 to 25 in the country. And the price of oil and gas was sub-zero. And our economy was tanking. You know, we were on the brink of collapse even before COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And so one of my main priorities is actually having a meaningful conversation about what a diversified economy for our country looks like, what our energy sector looks like in a diversified, you know, future-looking way. And those conversations have become so polarized that we can't even talk about them. It's very much turned into this: are you for us or are you against us? And I'll say it's that way on both sides of the equation a little bit. So that's a big piece of what I want to see in this next. This is what I want to see is stop with the rhetoric, stop you know, name calling back and forth across the House. Let's come up with a plan. Let's figure out how we can go forward, and let's, you know, start protecting Alberta, start protecting Alberta workers, and start protecting our climate.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, I've only been in Alberta since I started school there 4 years ago now, I think, ish. But what it really sounds like to me is that so many Albertans have been told for 4 or 5 decades is that if we're not, you know, exclusively supporting the energy sector, then we don't have an economy. And if we're not doing things exactly this way, then we don't have an economy. And governments were doing the same thing forever and ever. And the Alberta economy was like a roller coaster. And then, thank God, Rachel Notley got elected and she started diversifying and stabilizing. But now Jason Kenney's in and is just like bulldozing everything. And I think it's just, I feel like it's become so ingrained in some people's mind and in some areas, maybe even the culture of Alberta, that talk of diversifying or doing anything different is dangerous to the economy. And it means you're going to lose your job and never work again.
Definitely. And I think that politicians have played a really, really key and very unfortunate role in that discussion, you know, that they're, there has been so little space or so little time given to a real frank discussion about the future of our province, of our economy. You know, even if, and don't get me wrong, I am not expecting that there's, you know, I'm not against any industry or another, but even if oil and gas continue to produce the same number of barrels and whatnot, there aren't jobs there. The industry itself is becoming efficient and jobs are being, you know, automated, and there's not a future there the same way that there used to be. And there is an exciting future in Alberta. There are lots of things we could be doing. You know, we could be leaders. We are innovators. We are smart. You know, we have this history of really thinking creatively and doing problem solving and whatnot. So we absolutely could. And you're right. Rachel Notley was, you know, we were already thinking about upgrading and you know, diversifying and what alternative energies looked like and orphan wells and how we would be cleaning up our orphan wells. We're looking at some of the, you know, the great things coming out of AI and different industries. I think it's a conversation that needs to happen. And frankly, it's important to remember that Alberta is not just oil and gas. We are also, you know, the service industries. We are also technological industries, agriculture, forestry. There's a number of things that are Albertan. And we just need to change the channel. We need to change the narrative on that.
Yeah. That just reminded me, and I hope you don't mind my asking, because this isn't something I mentioned earlier, but just remind me, I was wondering if you could speak briefly about your thoughts on Bill 1, which is something that my friends have been talking about a lot and been asking me about a lot, that's currently about to pass in the Alberta legislature. And for those of you, and for our listeners who don't know, if you could explain essentially what it is and what it does.
Well, again, I mean, this is a provincial issue, and of course, there's a majority government in place right now. So, so Bill 1 is, I mean, not really an area that I would say that I'm the most up to date on. But Basically, what it is it's saying that, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Dylan, but it's basically saying that. It's a pushback against protesting, against, with very, very punitive fines against groups or individuals that interfere with critical infrastructure. So, and basically what that means is that it was a political move by Jason Kenney and the UCP to sort of pushback at the time on the Wet'suwet'en protests and the blockades that had crippled some of our rail lines and whatnot. It's a silencing bill. It's not democratic. It is the wrong direction to take. It is another perfect example of Jason Kenney preferring corporations and big business to the voices of Albertans. And frankly, because of where it came from, it's my opinion that it's also a very, very racist bill. I think that it is something that is put in place to silence marginalized populations, because who protests oil and gas development? Who protests major infrastructure development? You know, this is clearly intended to further shut down the ability of Albertans to have a good conversation about the future of our infrastructure, in my opinion.
That's my understanding of it as well. And thank you for answering the question. I know you're probably swamped on the federal level already, and there's everything happening in the provinces. It's It's a lot, and didn't have any.
It is interesting. I mean, it's a funny role that I have right now, and I would just mention too that, like, it's interesting to be an Albertan, to be an Edmontonian, to be a mother, to, you know, to have all of these different roles. So, you know, of course, this is vitally important to me. It may not be vitally, you know, it may not be my job to know these things, but it is as important to me as it should be for all Albertans.
Yeah.
So even though I'm the federal MP, I'm also, you know, deeply concerned about cuts to our education system, because I have two children that are in that education system.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So,
lighten it up a bit.
Yeah, lighten it up a bit from there, and then we'll we'll go into sort of rebuilding the economy, a more longer question. But before that, we thought it might be fun to do what we have written down here as quick hits, which is just sort of like this or that questions. Maybe we'll talk about them, maybe we'll just say, you know, move on right away. But just to hear your choices between two different options, or light thing, something light, something fun.
So
let's do it.
Cats or dogs?
See, I can't answer this one. I have to do both. I have one each.
fair enough. Already starting with a hard one. next, social democracy or democratic socialism?
Oh, when I saw this one, I was like, it really does depend on the day. But considering the week we've had, democratic socialism.
All right.
That's why I'm nailing it.
Summer or winter?
These are hard. These are not light. These are hard. Summer.
Aaron O'Toole or Peter McKay?
Gross. Neither.
Apple or Android?
Apple.
Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren?
Elizabeth Warren. We need more women in politics.
Yes.
Agreed. Coffee or tea?
Coffee until noon, tea until...
Also a good answer. Pierre Trudeau or Justin Trudeau?
Pierre.
Beer or wine?
See, again, this is another one of the both. It's terrible to say, but both. Yeah. Both.
And then last one, Ed Broadbent or Jack Layton?
I have to say Jack Layton. Yeah, I actually got to chat with Ed Broadbent earlier this year. He's phenomenal. Like, what an inspirational leader. But Jack Layton, I mean, he lit our house on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an amazing election that year.
Absolutely. You know, actually, I think, was it under Ed Broadbent? Because we have a relative who ran for the federal NDP in Parry Sound, Muskoka, I think. Was that under Broadbent?
I think so. I'm not 100%, but I think so. He got crushed.
Nice. Oh, yeah, nice. No, he didn't win, unfortunately, but he ran. He put his name forward.
Parry Sound NDP is pretty blue.
Yeah. But, you know,
Parry Sound, Muskoka is pretty blue.
Yeah. I have to say, though, in those districts where, you know, it's almost guaranteed that you're party's not going to win, putting your name forward and running anyway is a very brave thing to do, I think.
Extraordinarily brave.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Thank God for people who are willing to do that, because it's not easy, I'm sure. I'm sure it's not easy to run in a riding where you're have a good chance of winning.
Well, you're expected to win
if
you don't.
You certainly never know you have a good chance of winning until the election night is over.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I did not feel 100% confident on October 20th.
Yeah. Oh, I remember I had a sort of like election night party at my house, and I had a few friends over, and we were always like, it was covering the whole country, but every time Edmonton Strathcona we'd come up, like, we're desperately looking at the screen, and there was a point of time where you're checking the numbers desperately, and there's a point of time where Sam Lilly, who ran for the Conservatives, he was slightly ahead, and when I announced that, everyone in the house just screamed because they were so nervous. But then, you know, you beat him by 10 points. You crushed him a little bit.
We made it in the end. It's true. Yeah,
absolutely. So I know we have to let you go soon. We're at 53, basically 54 minutes. But ending on maybe something a little bit more uplifting, after COVID ends, because it will, things will start to, you know, the pandemic will lighten up and things will start to reopen. So when that starts to happen, when we get this under control, what do we do? How do we start rebuilding? Because there's going to be lots of jobs lost, lots of people who are just like out of money, and the federal government's going to be in one big hole when it comes to the deficit.
That maybe isn't as light as you intended to end.
I'm hoping you provide the light part.
Well, so yeah, we actually have put a task force together. Actually, Doug Mead asked myself and Charlie Angus and Daniel Blakey, three MPs, to lead the task force for the NDP that could look at what are the lessons that we need to learn? What do we want to make sure happens when we come out of this this schmozzle, I guess. And you know, we've already seen that the Conservatives, they are hardcore going towards austerity. Stephen Harper wrote in the Wall Street Journal about the need for austerity coming out of this and whatnot, which is ridiculous. I mean, realistically, we have gone down the austerity path before. We have done Reaganomics. We have done structural adjustment programs. You know, we've done Thatcherism. We know what this looks like. It is not the answer. We've even had the experience of being able to see different countries who have used austerity versus stimulus, you know, looking at things like Greece and Portugal and which situation works better, looking at some of our some of these countries that like New Zealand who've done so well coming out of the pandemic, and also in terms of looking at what is our economy for? What is our society for? It's actually not for the corporations. It's not for the multinationals. It's for the people. And so what's the best way to go forward? And I think, well, COVID has uncovered some really uncomfortable truths. It's also shown us that we've got the ability to do fundamental, massive change in this world. It's possible. It happened incredibly fast. We can do it. So well, yes, of course, we can see that the society we have right now has people that 2 weeks into this pandemic could not buy groceries, that, you know, a week into this pandemic couldn't pay their rent. We also got our very first, or may get our very first trillionaire. So if that's not an indication of a system that is deeply broken and needs to be changed, I don't know what is. You know, we know that women were disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. We know that if we're not careful, the recovery will leave women behind, and we will lose the ground that we gained over the last several years. We know that the developing world will feel the impacts of COVID-19 and will be less able to manage those impacts. So we also have to make sure that our supports for developing countries is in place. But we've seen how fast we can mobilize. We've seen what it looks like when there is global will. And that gives me so much hope, because it means that we can respond to the climate crisis. You know, we can respond to inequality. We can build an economy that doesn't leave people behind, that takes care of everyone. Like, we have the answers, we have the options, and it really, it's one of the most exciting times to be a politician, because what we decide now, what we decide in the next 6 or 12 months, will fundamentally change our world for the next several decades to come. And now's the time to grasp the possible and to think about what we could be building. And I mean, I think it's fascinating, super exciting. And I'm open to anything. Like, if anyone has any ideas and wants to talk about it, I love the idea of what we could build here. So there's my hopeful cheer, rallying call. Oh. Let's get to work and fix some of these problems.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, I really love what I've been hearing a lot from the New Democrats and from progressives around the world, which is, let's not go back to normal after this. Let's move forward. And I think that's a great message. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that hour really flew by. I want to say thank you for joining us. It was a great conversation, and hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Well, really interesting. Yeah, and it'd be great to do it again. And thanks for having me.
Thank you. Well, that was great having Heather on.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Yeah. That was exciting.
It really was. And somebody who actually, you know, is in Parliament and hopefully she sounds like she's excited to actually make some changes and take some action, which is important.
Yeah. I mean, we absolutely need that's exactly the type of people we need running for office.
Yeah. Out of whatever party, that's what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I do think the one thing I will say here versus the States, I don't know. I think everybody here in Parliament, well, most people in Parliament are doing what they truly believe is best for the country. Whereas I think down south, he's not.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I also think that the vast majority of parliamentarians run for office because they do want to make changes, because there's things that they see and they believe in, that they believe are best for the country, like you said. And I think they're working towards that. In the States, I think there's a problem where maybe you could say that 90% of people start running like that, but you have so many like senators who've been serving for like 40 years who I think you just get complacent at some point. Stop caring that
I was mostly referring to Trump though, because after I mean he's only been in government three years.
Yes.
And there's no sign that he's in it for anyone other than himself and his friends.
No, absolutely. You're 100% right. You're 100% right.
We did have that because we had Heather on, we devoted the whole segment to this, but there are a few things that so much happened this week that I just want to mention, and hopefully we can delve more next week.
Yeah.
But we had Trump threatening to use military on U.S. soil, which is, you know, to quell the protests, which is, I mean, it's fascism.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's absolutely authoritarianism blatantly and is extraordinarily close to fascism.
Called for arrests of the protesters with jail terms.
Yeah. I mean, this is, it's absurd. And I'm sure, I mean, I'm not a U.S. constitutional expert, but I'm sure it's unconstitutional to do something like that. But they do have a big loophole where the president is commander in chief of the military, and Congress doesn't need to approve anything, and he kind of can just order them to do whatever he wants. That's how you got the war in Iraq.
Yeah, well, we'll see how that plays out over the next week. Also, there was a lot of cases, and I wanted to go over them one by one, but we don't have time, but a lot of cases, maybe we can talk about it next week, maybe we'll see more of it, of people stepping in and helping during the protests, helping police that were in trouble, helping other people that were in trouble, helping stores that were being looted or whatever.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's a good thing. These aren't cops. These are just regular people that are protesting that want to protest peacefully and are trying to get it done.
And they want to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And that's the way. That's the vast majority of the protesters, outside of a small group of agitators, which, you know, it's not good. You need to get rid of the agitators. It's kind of the flip side of saying you need to get rid of the bad cops and you need to get rid of the agitators. But the vast majority of the protesters want to protest peacefully, and they're making a very good, and it's for a very good cause, and it's good people.
Yeah. And it is also more than getting rid of the bad cops. It's changes to the system.
When you have
the New York City, which spends more on policing than it does on the departments of health, homeless services, housing prevention and development, housing preservation, development, and youth and community development combined. You know, you're that's an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the U.S. in the police in the U.S. are decked out like they're the military.
The also a problem when the protest in Buffalo. There was an elderly gentleman who was shoved down by two policemen, and was in distress.
I mean, I think he's still in the hospital in critical condition.
Yeah, absolutely. Last I heard.
Yeah.
But, you know, these two officers were suspended pending an investigation.
I think they've been charged with assault.
Now.
Yeah.
But initially, they were suspended without pay pending an investigation. And because of that action, which is almost as little as you can do in that situation.
Yeah.
The other 57 members of the emergency response team quit the emergency response team.
And I think that's maybe one of the biggest problems in policing that is maybe not talked about as much, or at least isn't at the forefront as much, is there's a culture of defending your own no matter what. And you can't, like, I understand that you want the fraternity brotherhood, you want to know in dangerous situations when you're a cop that the people you're with have your back, but also people need to be held accountable. That needs to be the standard. You need to know that if you cross the line, if you do something wrong as a cop, that you're not going to be allowed to get away with it, and you're not going to be defended just because you're a cop, and that's when you lose the right to that support.
And you can't have their, society needs to know that the police has their back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The system is rigged in their favor. It is made so that when they cross the line, there are no consequences. And that is how we have gotten so long to this point. And, just funding for a second. Is it the NYPD that have a tank?
I don't think that was the NYPD. They probably do. But the specific tank that was on that video we were watching, I don't think was NYPD.
But the fact that any police force has a tank,
it's a problem.
If a situation gets to a point where you need the tank, just call in the military.
Yeah.
Don't like.
It's calling the National Guard. They don't use the military on.
Oh yeah.
On soil.
Different. Whatever. But well, they don't yet. Call in the National Guard. The police force.
Like what happens here in Canada, we do call in the military when things escalate beyond what the police can handle.
Yeah, we shouldn't. I guess.
Or it's a really bad snowstorm.
Yeah. I guess the point I'm trying to make, and maybe it doesn't sound right, but I think it's true, is that the police don't need to be equipped to handle every situation. I think there's a certain level where it's the police, and then you bump it up to the National Guard, and then you bump it up to whatever's above that. But the police don't need a tank. They don't. They don't need military gear of any kind. They barely need helicopters.
There was also a horrible situation in Asheville, North Carolina, where police destroyed a medic area, puncturing bottles of water because they said they were projectiles, and just like destroying an area that was set up to help the protesters that had medical distress.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in full riot gear, they're worried about getting hit with water bottles. Meanwhile, they're shooting rubber bullets at peaceful protesters.
Which they don't actually... I read somewhere, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I read it in an article that said they don't call them non-lethal, they call them less lethal, because they can do a lot of damage.
Yeah. There are many examples of police... not even just, like, now I just see them, they're not even using just excessive force. They are purposefully victimizing themselves to try to, I guess, sway public opinion to their side. Like it's just so pathetic.
Yeah, but the other thing that you have to mention, if you're mentioning the bad things, is the good parts. And there was a lot of police that joined the protesters.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Did a good job of protecting peacefully and letting people protest across the country. There was a lot of good jobs done. They don't get mentioned. It's the bad ones that do.
Yeah.
Which is, you have to stop the bad ones, but let's make sure we start thanking the police that do a good job.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's interesting because I saw when we had the marches in Toronto just this past week, Mark Saunders, who's the chief of police for Toronto, went out to meet first at protesters, and the first thing he did was to take a knee, him and his entire command staff. They went out, they took a knee, they talked to protesters, and he talked about the need that the most important thing is to connect and listen and learn to do better. And I think it's very interesting in this moment where when this is happening, because Mark Saunders is a black man and he's chief of police. And I think that gives him a perspective on this that not a lot of people have.
Yeah. And I do, I do, I, hope to go into these sort of kindness by police one by one, but you know, we just don't have time this week. We can maybe look at it next week. And then on Friday, Trump sort of said they won. Hopefully George is looking down right now and saying, this is a great thing that is happening for our country. This is a great day for our country. This is a great day for him. It's a great day for everybody. This is a great day for everybody. This is a great, great day in terms of equality.
And he was talking about the job numbers, right?
Mostly. But yeah. He also was talking about the... he was just in a good mood because job numbers went up. But it's the day after... two days after he sent the police in to clear the peaceful protest so he could get the photo up.
I don't know.
Is that Wednesday or Thursday?
I don't remember. I just remember it's ridiculous.
But it's far from a great, great day in terms of equality.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what I learned? I learned that tear gas is banned during wars under the Geneva Convention.
Yeah, well, they apparently didn't use tear gas there. They used pepper spray and smoke flashbangs, but they said it essentially amounts to the same thing. So, but they're trying to get out of actually calling it that. Now, one other thing I read today that just sort of threw me for a loop. There is a Looney Tunes reboot coming, and they said Elmer Fudd will not carry a gun. Instead, he will carry a scythe.
Yeah, I read that too.
How is that any better?
I
don't think anybody's anti-hunting.
Well, no, there are people who are anti-hunting.
But most people aren't anti-hunting.
Yeah.
He doesn't, Elmer Fudd doesn't have an AK-47 or an assault rifle. He's just hunting rabbits.
Yeah.
Hunting rabbits.
I also think a scythe is...
It's the
Grim Reaper,
the Grim Reaper
it looks much more menacing. And also, it's just not practical.
And also, it's Looney Tunes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I have to say... In the article I read, it showed how, the older Looney Tunes were much more violent than what it became.
The good Looney Tunes.
I have to say, no, I've seen some of the older Looney Tunes, and I was shocked by like the amount of blatant, but like there's so many where like Donald or Daffy or Bugs like kill themselves in the end.
The other thing that, just going back a minute, but the other thing is they're still going to use TNT.
Yes, they are still going to use dynamite.
What? Where's the line being drawn? That's worse.
I don't know. They might. I mean, maybe eventually they'll just get rid of that. I mean.
Then don't do Looney Tunes.
I was about to say, there's an argument to just not do Looney Tunes and make something new.
Yeah. Anyway, we should probably wrap it up so we don't bore people too much.
Hopefully, yeah.
Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week with episode 9.
Yeah, and thanks again for Heather. Thanks to Heather. And I think she's the first person we've like interviewed. Like, we've had guests, but I feel like we like interviewed her.
Yeah.
So now we've set a standard that, you know, we'll probably not be able to meet again.
Hey, thanks a lot.